one of my favorite songwriters and singers, Andrew Peterson, Invisible God. We heard from Margaret Becker, Your Glory Be Ever Known, from Michael Card. Song about the New Jerusalem. And it's 12 minutes past the hour, past 8 o'clock here in the Central Time Zone. It's past 9 o'clock in the Eastern Time Zone. That's where Doug Greenwald is right now. He's at the home base for Preserving Bible Times in Columbia, Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. And Doug, you're getting ready to depart today, aren't you? You're a busy guy. You've got to have a full plate today.
I am. I'm about 90 minutes from walking out the front door here and heading for the airport and overnighting to Rome.
So most of your time will be spent sitting today and waiting for something to happen, a plane to take
and
off.
And thinking and integrating and pulling together the final touches on the church history and Paul's Roman world reflections and anecdotes insights
some of your best work on the airplane, don't you?
Actually, at 30,000, once they get above 30,000 feet, some really remarkable things happen. I mean, it's like the last five trips, even in the United States, particularly on Southwest Airlines. I'll put a plug in for them. But when I start heading west on Southwest and get above 30,000 feet, and lean back in my chair and close my eyes, the ideas and the thoughts and the phrases just start coming. And so, you know, I kind of look forward to airline flights, but not necessarily long ones like this one, unless I can get a bulkhead seat. And fortunately, there was an angel of mercy disguised as a person on the phone for Delta Airlines who got me bulkhead seats coming and going on this trip.
Okay, well, so what you're telling me is the higher the altitude, that is, the lower the atmospheric pressure, the more creative you get. I think maybe you should
something like that, or the higher up I get, the more I can look down and see more expansively, or something like that. I'm unsure,
but could well be.
I'll take it.
This will be the third trip to Italy for Preserving Bible Times, right?
It is, and the fourth one's already on the calendar for end of April next year, and we've got it down. I want to say cold. We always find new things we can add, and I'll certainly be doing that on this trip. But at the 95% plus level, we've got the glitches shaken out of this one, and it works well.
Well, for those of you just tuning in, maybe new to Doug Greenwald and what he does, Preserving Bible Times is a ministry that reconstitutes first century context into what we read in Scripture, and in so doing, just brings it to life. It makes it full color, four dimensions, and we've learned so much from Doug over the years. We have now a library of close to 4 years' worth of conversations with Doug, most of them on the historic and cultural context of first century Israel, the Hebrew culture, that is. But for the last couple of years, and now with this new trip coming up to Italy, we're going to be learning a whole lot more about the Roman Empire. Now, Doug, I should just speak for me, I suppose. I can't speak for the world in this, but when I think of the Roman Empire, I think of something grandiose and big and ordered. And I see row on row of legionnaires, the Roman legions marching on neighboring countries with swords flashing and shining armor and those bright red feather helmets on. And I think of multi-story buildings. I think of aqueducts and harbors like at Caesarea. And I think of grandiose things, big things. They really set a standard for the first century, didn't they? Were they civilization then?
Pretty much. And, you know, if you last over 950 years, you had to have been doing some things right.
Yeah, I suppose.
And speaking of the Roman legionaries, I was reading up on them this week. At its apex, there were only 150,000 legionaries.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and roughly either 4,800 or 5,500 per legion, depending on which sources you read, and no more than 30 such legions. And what's amazing to me is that 150,000 men could keep the whole world at peace for so long. In fact, there were some periods of time when there went almost 200 years and they never fought a war. They never had to squash a rebellion. So if you were a Roman legionary, you spent a lot of your time on building projects. In fact, most of the Roman road system, which is estimated to be from 30,000 to 50,000 miles, which allowed these legionnaires these legions to quickly move around the empire were built by the legionaries themselves. Mm-hmm. And so as glorious as being a Roman legionnaire was, what you really were, you majored in building projects.
Yeah, highway crews and aqueduct builders. Yeah. And remaking of cities. You've mentioned to us a couple times now that they once they would conquer a territory, they would tend to remake the major cities as really a mirror image of Rome. The same thought, the same patterns of the buildings, even down to the dimensions of the streets and the heights of the curbs.
Yeah, to the extent that they could, but oftentimes they built new cities because the population would be drawn from the countryside into the cities. And so cities is where the Roman Empire is really at, and so they spent a lot of time on design of their cities. I have a whole book here on how Rome designed a city, and if you read that, you'd come to the conclusion that these guys never did anything wrong. In fact, it must have really been nice to live in a city, and that couldn't be further from the truth.
Well, you described for us last week some of the really the horrors of the densely populated slum areas, tenement areas is the only way to describe them, that we tend not to think of when we think of the Roman Empire. We think of colonnades and palaces and colosseums and the huge buildings, at least huge for the time that they had built, masters of the concrete construction projects. But there was another side to Rome, wasn't there? And I wanted to ask you a question. What were the population centers then? I mean, obviously Rome itself, the city of Rome. Ephesus, I know, was a large and very successful Roman city. But what would you say? Carthage, this was after the Punic War, so they pretty much dominated North Africa. Where else were they?
Well, Alexandria was Alexandria, huge. Of course, right. Athens. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Antioch and Tarsus, in Asia Minor, were very substantial cities. But as glorious as the Roman Empire seemed at 30,000 feet, once you got down to ground level for the majority of the people, it was a very, very difficult daily reality. And last week we started on that journey. I wanted to cover seven issues. One, urban disorder. Second, social dislocation, and that's about as far as we got last week. But before I pick up a theme called filth beyond your imagination, let me just repeat the question. We ended our time last week in the social dislocation discussion. And this is a quote from the first century, one of the commentators. The average family lived a squalid life in filthy and cramped quarters, where one half of children died in childbirth or infancy, and one parent died before any of the surviving children could reach maturity. All right? And that's just the social dislocation side of life. But when we walk, as we will tomorrow, we'll walk through Ostia Antica, the ancient working port of Rome. It'll be quiet. It'll be peaceful. There'll be lovely Roman umbrella pine trees all over the place, providing shade. There'll be one and two-story walls left on a number of structures. But what we will be missing is the stench of everyday Roman life. And by that, I meant the stench comes from a number of reasons. A minor stench would be the stench of urine. There are urine collection pots all over the city, and if you're a good citizen, you will relieve yourself pretty much in a public way into these large urine collection pots, because urine is what's used to clean togas. It's the bleach of its day, and there's a three-day process by which your toga, which gets bleached in urine and then set out to be dried in the sun and bleached again and dried out some more. So one of the overwhelming smells you will have is that of urine on a daily basis. But a more pungent smell will be that of sewage. And I think you know what I'm referencing to when I say sewage.
Yeah.
Because when Rome built the city, they actually put a sewer system in place. I mean, they actually thought of such things. There were toilets, actually, for the very wealthy people, running water and toilets. But as the cities exploded and as the people from the countryside came into town and tenements began to spring up, there was no sewerage accommodation constructed. And so everything was driven by chamber pots.
Now, you told us that you just mentioned two-story buildings. You'll see two-story buildings tomorrow, but there was a time when those buildings were taller.
That's right, because what we're going to see are the two-story brick first two levels, but what's missing are the wooden fourth, fifth, and sixth levels. Okay? They're gone. All six stories of these tenements were not necessarily built with brick, and of course the interior was all wood. And since they were not on any sort of plumbing system connected to the pre-existing sewers when the city was first built, everything was collected in chamber pots. And if you lived in the fifth or sixth story, you didn't necessarily relish the thought of carrying your chamber pot down six flights of stairs and then down maybe three blocks on the street to the public latrine where you would dump your chamber pot. And so a lot of people said nuts to that. They just take their chamber pot, go over to a window that faces the street, and dump it out. And so walking on a sidewalk in Roman daily life, whether it was Tarsus or Antioch or Rome itself, was like walking on an obstacle course of sewage. And not infrequently, somebody would lose control of their chamber pot, and chamber pots would come crashing down on the sidewalk. And there are actually people who got killed, you know, from chamber pots coming down six stories and hitting them on the head. So you can imagine the stench and the sewage, which is not only on the sidewalk, but is on in the gutters, so to speak, of these crowned streets that were built so precisely by the Romans. And the stench is just overwhelming. I mean, there's a reason why anyone who could afford it burned incense 24 hours a day. And at best, that sort of deflected your nose a little bit, but it did not overcome the stench. And so if you were wealthy by any stretch of anybody's imagination, you wanted to have a villa on the sea or a country place so that you could be in a place where the fresh winds blew and you didn't have this sort of pungent aroma daily on the hour, 24/7 in your nostrils. And this is a backdrop that Paul draws upon when he encourages these new believers in Jesus Christ to be the aroma of Christ in that culture. If you're going to be an aroma that's detectable, you better be pretty strong, pretty persistent to cut through all these other odors that just permeate block after block and street after street of a typical Roman city. And so, you know, it's not the sweet little delicate something of a French perfume that would totally get overwhelmed, that would totally get lost in your nostrils here in this culture. So I think it's an interesting way to think about what does it mean to be the aroma of Christ. It means to be pronounced, persistent, and very much detectable in a stenching culture. Hmm.
And it would mean to overlay everything else that you have known. It would be a whole new layer of life in a sense.
Exactly. And, you know, here's another way to think about it. Sometimes people spill their chamber pots in their own one-room apartments on the fifth floor of these tenements. Well, how do you clean that up? You have no soap. There is no disinfectant. Okay? Water is fairly precious. I mean, you want water to drink, but you're not going to be trucking up and down five and six flights of stairs with a lot of water to use for cleaning and cleansing like we would mop a floor or something like that. And so not only do the streets stink, but your apartment stinks. And everywhere you turn, you've got this pungent aroma. And then on maybe every other block, there's going to be a corpse lying in the gutter. So, you know, welcome to filth beyond our imagination, a daily reality of everyday Roman city life.
Now, you talk about the orderliness of Rome, Now we're talking about tenements, and this sounds more like chaos. Is it maybe the case that they ignored the lower classes? They simply chose not to deal with. They may not have recognized the health problems, although I've got to believe they did. And so that if the government was by and for wealthy people, they would have simply ignored these areas of the big cities.
Well, I don't know if they ignored them as much as it was they just viewed it as impossible to correct. I mean, once all this stuff is built up and all the streets have 4, 5, and 6-story tenements, you can't reconstruct it and put in sewers. You can't reconstruct it and put in plumbing. You just sort of have to live with it. And so, I mean, if we look at our inner cities today, I mean, they're not always a perfect picture of how things ought to be. We all know that, but yet they still continue. And so I think there's a parallel in that thinking for ancient Rome. And so with that as a backdrop, is there any doubt that disease is a huge issue in daily life in the Roman culture?
I'm guessing short lifespans.
It's most would say 40, 42 years of age, but in some cities that were just totally out of control, like Antioch, it is estimated that the average life was just 30 years. So a lot of death, a lot of quick death. And so you've got insects, you've got flies, you've got mosquitoes everywhere, and they're carrying diseases. There are no disinfectants. As a result, almost everyone is dealing with an illness or some sort of physical affliction. And it's these illnesses and these physical afflictions that just dominate everyday life. And so as you look around, everyone is anemic. And every other person you see is dealing with a chronic disease. It could be skin rashes or other diseases that you're vulnerable to in this sort of situation. And so the notion of a healthy population just flat out isn't there. In fact, it's the absolute converse. You hardly know anyone is healthy. And so with that kind of a backdrop, can you understand why the miracle of healing in the body of Christ has considerable appeal in these house churches?
Yeah, I can. And like I can see it in contrast with the polytheism that was Rome. And I suspect, and in some of my readings of Plato and the like, I got the feeling that even the ancient Greeks by the 3rd or 4th century BC were pretty well fed up with their pantheon of gods. In other words, it made no sense. They were caricatures of what gods were to be. They were far too human to be respected, to be worshipped, to be highly thought of. And religion became a series of events that were really economic events. They were festivals, they were celebrations, they were ways to party and to make money. And the same thing must have happened to Rome by the time of the first century. I mean, there was no good alternative to what Paul was offering. People had to be searching for something. They had to be ripe for this.
And, you know, when we say Rome, we really mean the Roman world.
Yes.
It isn't just the city of Rome itself. I mean, what we're seeing in Rome, we're observing in Tarsus, we're observing in Antioch, okay? Mm-hmm. It's just not localized in Rome. This is life in the Roman world. And so when you pull these themes together that we've already covered, daily life is one of misery. Extremely high mortality rates, as we've already discussed, extremely high infant mortality. Swollen eyes, skin rashes, and lost limbs are just a permanent part of the daily scene. And remember, all water is carried in iron pipes. And we know what lead poisoning
pipes, yeah.
Lead does. Pipes. Mm-hmm. You know, even in our culture today, you can imagine the impact it had back then. And the other part that's missing here is just chronic infections, mostly on the feminine side, from childbirth and from repeated abortions, which were not cleanly done, were not neatly done. And so to be a woman is basically to be chronically infected from the residual effects of either childbirth or abortion. And so that everyone is pretty much living a life at different levels and degrees of misery.
Was abortion sanctioned in the Roman Empire?
Oh, absolutely. And so was infanticide. Particularly on the female side of life, a family never, most families didn't want more than one daughter. And so if a second and a third daughter was born, it would be not uncommon for that daughter immediately after being born to be taken out in the country and that baby placed in a ditch. Because sometimes it was done for boy babies as well, when a father did not want to have to divide his estate between too many sons. And so infanticide is very, very common. That's one of the things that Paul stopped immediately in these house churches. It's one of the reasons that the overall health of Christian women was better than the overall health of Roman women. It's why they had a longer lifespan than Roman women did. They had more relative freedom in Christianity than Roman women did in the pagan families. And so early Christianity was very appealing to women. I think that's one of the things that we overlook. But to carry on this...
Yeah, did that contribute to the growth of Christianity?
At a certain level it did, but what it contributed to was a mismatch of male-female relationships in the Roman world versus the Christian world. In the Roman world, there were 140 men for every 100 women. That ratio was like reversed to 150 women for every 100 men in the Christian world, because Christianity brought a lot of protection as well as a higher view of women. So not only did it help in their mortality, but in the it had cultural appeal, social appeal as well. You could be much more free as a woman than the average wife of a pagan Roman husband. And so that's part of what Paul has to deal with in marriages, when there weren't enough marriageable men for all the women in these house churches, and they were almost forced to marry a pagan husband. And some of Paul's comments about marriage and the unbelieving spouse needs to be understood from that contextual perspective. Hmm. So, with all this disease, with all this filth, with all this misery, there's yet another concern here. It's one of fear. Even today, the social scientists tell us that as social cohesion goes down, crime goes up in neighborhoods. And with all this rapid death rate and all these illnesses, there were lots of holes that needed to be filled by new workers. And so more and more people would come in every year from the rural countryside to take the places of the people who died. And they don't have any attachments. They don't have any family. They don't have any social networks. And so what you have is a whole lot of strangers in your communities. And when that happens, cohesion goes down and crime goes up. And what that meant was, when the sun went down, boy, everybody closed the doors of their homes and boarded up any windows that they had, and chaos was taking place out in the streets. One commentator observed, kind of with a bit of irony, that if you go out after dark, you better have your will updated. Okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how dangerous it was. And so, just to factor in a little bit, when did the house churches meet? They met at night. Why did they meet at night? Because servants and the slaves all had obligations during the day. The only time they were freed up was to meet at night. So for some Christians, even going to church, quote unquote, carried with it a bit of danger. And then on top of that, the fear of just crime and being beat up, being burglarized, having your money stolen off you. There were also epidemics from time to time. And there were riots. And from time to time, there were famines. As one commentator said, a litany of disasters so staggering that it is difficult to grasp its human meaning. Okay? Mm. That's how bad it was. a litany of disasters so staggering that it is difficult to grasp its human meaning. Every one of these one-room apartments in a tenement had a little small place where they did their cooking. Brasier, we would call them a very, very small charcoal grill. And so the breaking out of fires periodically was just very, very common. There is no firefighting system in place. And so once a fire would start, it would pretty much consume that particular tenement and probably jump to the adjoining tenements as well until the whole block burned down, okay? Not an uncommon occurrence. And so part of daily life was the smell of smoke and particulate matter, carbon particulate matter in the air to go along with the stenches. And because these tenement houses were not always built to code, in fact, very few of them would, at least our understanding of code, they were more weakly built from a framing point of view, from a joist point of view. And because the rents got cheaper and cheaper the higher you up, to the fourth, to the fifth, to the sixth floor in these tenements, they tended to be more crowded at the top of the tenement floors than they were at the bottom. And when they were poorly built, on a monthly basis, so it seems, a tenement would just collapse. You know, the sixth floor would drop on the fifth floor, which would drop on the fourth floor, and 80 to 100 people would die. And there you are. And so this notion of fear about fire, about collapsing buildings, about crime, is just a daily part of many portions of these Roman cities.
Would you say that all this combined to make people, especially at the poorer level, more receptive to Paul's teaching, to Paul's presence, to the presence of Christians in their neighborhood? Were Christians valued, looked up to? How were they received?
Well, let's just pause here for a moment.
Yeah.
As bad as everything just sounds that I recited here, this is daily normal life. This is the way normal life has been for people in cities since cities began. Okay, I mean, this is not new. People didn't say, wow, this is more bad. This is really bad. This is worse than anything else we've ever experienced. No, the attitude was, no, this is what it means to be poor. This is how it always has been for the poor. So there's that perspective. But now let's talk about Christianity. And just let me pick out epidemics. When measles I think it was chickenpox hit the Roman world, and if my dates are correct here, in like 156 AD and 251 AD, these are epidemics that last for pretty much a decade. You know, these are not 30-day phenomena. And the way the Romans dealt with that is that the moment someone got infected or came down with symptoms in their household, they put them on a cart, they took them out to the country, and they threw them in a ditch. Okay? That's the Roman world's way of dealing with epidemics. The moment somebody contracts something, take them out to the country, throw them in the ditch, and hope they die quickly. Well, the Christians, of course, got infected at the same rate, but because the Christians cared for one another, and care here is pretty basic, keep them hydrated with water and keep them nourished with food, okay? The Christian mortality rate was only 10% during these great epidemic decades. And, you know, once you had either one of these diseases and you survived at the 90% level, you now had antibodies against it. And so you could serve and minister for the next 8-9 years of people who were still coming down with this and not get infected yourself. Mm-hmm. So what the Christians began to do is go out into the countryside, and the moment that someone got thrown into a ditch from a pagan Roman family, they would start to nurse that person back to health. And guess what? If you hydrate them and if you give them food, they survive at the 90% level. And so the Roman culture looked at this phenomena after a year or two and basically said, this is miraculous. Look at how these Christians don't die at the same rates that we do. And that created a lot of affinity towards Christianity. And also at the same time, those pagans that had been nursed back to health, it created what the social scientists call attachments to these people. They cared for me. They saved my life. I want to spend the rest of my lives with these people. And so there were great spurts of conversion and great spurts of church growth in the midst of phenomenal epidemics. Isn't that fascinating?
It's interesting. I'm sure it's a complex process, but to think that longevity and resistance to disease was one of the reasons the church grew, not just because people lived longer and lived healthier lives, but because the outside society saw them and marveled at that.
Exactly, and they saw that their Christian women didn't die at the same rate, didn't have the same infections mm-hmm. that the pagan women had, you know, because of abortion practices and what have you. There were a lot of evidences here that things work out for the better.
Now, let's talk about numbers for just a minute here, because I'm thinking back to some of our past discussions, and I think it is, you mentioned, that during Paul's time, first century, there may have been perhaps as many as 1,000 Christians in his churches across the Roman Empire. And yet, by the time of Constantine, now we're looking at the early 4th century, there was 1,000,000.
You know what? That's a bigger topic than a 30-second observation. Why don't we start on the dynamics of early church growth when I get back, because there's 5 or 10 minutes worth of stuff to pass along there. But I'd like to wrap up this discussion of the misery realities of everyday mm-hmm. Roman life and point out that Christianity is a solution to the chaos of daily life. And if you want to use marketplace language, my background was 31 years in sales and marketing. There were many competitive advantages of Christianity vis-a-vis the daily realities of Greco-Roman daily life. For example, in the Christian world, there's healing. There's a sense of family. All this social dislocation, now you're actually in a community of people who know you and care for you and want the best place for you. You actually have a place to belong. The body of Christ offers immediate social and cultural attachments, so you're not a stranger in a crowd. It provides a sense of solidarity over all of the ethnic strife that was so common in a daily life in the Roman world. There was charity, there was grace, and hope replaced the notion of despair. And there also was the discovery that there is an eternal life. There is something beyond this misery that is just glorious, and it will last forever. And so, as quick a sketch as I've just done there about the good news, it really was good news. Christianity indeed had a superior capacity for responding to the mosaic of misery that was daily Roman life. It offered a new culture and a new community that made life in Greco-Roman cities more tolerable than ever before. And so, with that as a backdrop, now we want to ask, if that's true, then how fast did the church grow? And the quick answer is, it really grew very, very slowly. And we'll talk about some of the dynamics about that when I get back from Italy.
And we'll look forward to that. What a great title, The Competitive Advantages of Christianity. Just the notion that it's competing, but it really has. It really has been a competition all through these eons. Doug, have a safe trip. Bless you and your group over there. Come back with some rich stories for us and teach us some more, okay?
Thanks, Jim. Shalom, shalom.
Shalom to you. Doug Greenwald, Preserving Bible Times. The website, preservingbibletimes.org. You can link to it right from our site at Broken Road Radio. Doug, take care. Bye-bye.